Now, that's part of the post-thesis, is the cosmic temple. Now we ask the question, whose home is it? Okay, God didn't need a home. He had existed from eternity past with no home, and that was just fine. But he was ready to create us. And so he prepared a place for us. Jesus is still preparing a place for us in new creation. But he prepared a place for us. And the idea was that he was going to live there. So he was building a home to function for us. Go back to the B&B idea. He built this house. Okay, and by the way, let me be clear on that. God is the one who built the house. I'm not questioning that. I'm asking the question, which part of the story is Genesis 1 telling? Is it telling the house story or the home story? Okay, so God built the house, but then at some point he decided to make that a home for people in his image. And he intended to be in relationship with them, so he was going to live there too. So that's what we call the cosmic temple idea. Now the cosmos as sacred space is a well-known idea in the ancient world. If you were to give this text of Genesis, okay, imagine with me, the first creation conference in the history of the world. The Babylonians are there. The Assyrians are there. The Sumerians are there. They get takes them to the trip. Egypt, plenary speaker. Okay, they've got some really important stuff going on to discuss cosmology. Moses comes as representative of the Israelites. Comes his time to present his paper, and he lays out Genesis 1. And everybody kind of thumbs through it. They were supposed to read it ahead of time, but nobody ever does. Okay, so they thumb through it, and they say, oh, Moses, this is a temple story. And Moses nods his head, yes. And they say, oh, yeah, that's going to help me do it, too. And we're sitting there, you know, kind of around the outside, saying, wait a minute, hold on, I've read the chapter, the temple is not a word that's there. What do you mean it's a temple account? What's up with that? He said, well, this is perfectly clear. It's very clear this is a temple. Now, here we're talking high context, low context, okay? For them, it's very clear in a high context, the temple is what's being discussed here. We're low context, and we don't see it. How would they have come to that conclusion? They came to that conclusion because the text says that God rested. Which is clear as can be to them. Because God's rest in temples. It's the only place God's rest. And temples are built for gods to rest in. If you've got God resting, you have a temple. And the Babylonians especially would add, duh, because they're kind of, you know, in space. Okay, so the fact is that in the ancient world, gods rest in temples, and temples are constructed for deity to rest in. That tells us that Genesis 1 is a temple account. Of course, it goes a little bit to chapter 2, but you know what I mean. It's a temple account. Now, that makes sense with the house versus home, because now God is making the house, which he built, into his home, which is a quantum leap and an important step. He's making this house his home, and then inviting us in, his creatures, as his honored guests. People may be the climax of 6 days, and we are. The text lays it out that way, but rest is the climax of the creation account. After all, if the idea is a temple in which God is dwelling, then if God's not in it, we haven't hit the most important part yet. In Israel, would they ever consider any significance as attaching to a temple in which God did not dwell? Remember, Ezekiel saw the presence of God leaving, and they said, this is horrible, because now the temple is just a building. A temple is when God's in it, and that does not exist as a temple until God enters it. And if this is a temple text, day 7 is the most important point, because it's meaningless without it. Now, if you're moving into a new place, new apartment, new house, and you've got all your boxes, they're all everywhere, and things are a mess. There's a lot of non-order, because everything's packed in boxes, and nothing's functioning the way that it should. The house is there, the home is not functioning yet. But it's been designed to function, and you're going to put it in order. So you spend a lot of time unpacking the boxes, put everything where it belongs, cabinets, closets, furniture, putting everything exactly where it belongs. Okay, when you're all done, everything's ordered, now you take a nap. Well, you might, but after your nap, you don't then pack it all up and leave. You didn't just unpack your boxes and move in so you could take a nap. That kind of rest was not your goal. You ordered your world so that you could reside in it and have some control over your environment. And that's what rest is. Rest is not relaxation, leisure, a nap. It is now having everything ordered, and now you can operate in that order. Rest was the main goal of creation. God was ordering the cosmos to function as His home, our home. It was designed to function for that, and God's setting it up to do that. Rest is the main goal. But we're still not going to understand that if we think of rest as disengagement. Rest is not disengagement, but it's engagement over an ordered system. Engagement in what way? How is God engaging by resting? Well, with resting, think about residing. Or think about something even better than that. We'll go to it in a second. What's happening when God resolves unrest, we get rest. Think about the Israelites. God says, I'm going to bring you into that land, and I'm going to give you rest from your enemies. That means He's going to bring order and control to their environment so they can live their lives. Okay? It doesn't mean He's going to give them a Sunday afternoon nap. Okay? That really wouldn't be worth the trouble. God gives rest to resolve unrest. So rest is not the opposite of active. Rest is the opposite of unrest. And unrest is resolved by bringing order and control. Now, does the Bible give us this information? Yes, it does indeed. Psalm 132, let us go to His dwelling place. You see temple there. Let us worship at His footstool, the ark. Lord, come to your resting place. Temple, ark, rest. The temple is His resting place. You and the ark of your might, the Lord has chosen Zion. He's desired it for His dwelling. This is my resting place forever. Not just resting one day. Now, that doesn't mean God is an eternal snooze, soul sleep or something. Resting place forever, ever. How does that reflect itself? Here I will sit enthroned. Rest equals rule. God is exercising His control over the system that He ordered for that very purpose. So God has made the cosmic house, cosmic sacred space, by inhabiting it, by coming to dwell there. And the order that He brought was so that He could rule over it. And so that He could bring us into that ordered system to be in relationship with Him. That's the home story. And the house story pales in comparison. And we're so interested in the house story that we can't take our minds off it. And we keep trying to make Genesis 1 be a house story. Because that's our culture, and that's our agenda, and that's our interests. And in the process, we've missed the very important elements that are supposed to be here in the text. Because we've tried to read it as a modern text with modern interests, instead of an ancient text with ancient interests. Now, how's the 7 days fit into this? Okay, when Solomon built the temple. Spent 7 years, remember, building the temple? The stone, the shaping it, and hauling it, and putting it in place, all the gold, and the furniture, and the vestments, the priests, the veil, all this work, the material stuff, building the house. Solomon spent 7 years building the house. When he's done, does the temple exist? Your head should be going like this. It'll help you keep awake too, so, okay? No, the temple doesn't exist. The structure's there, the house part's done, it's ready to be a temple, but it can't be a temple by definition until God is in it. Now, how do we make the transition from a house to a home? from that structure to a temple. How does the temple come to exist? We know how the house came to exist. Okay, but how does the temple come to exist? Well, that involves a process. It's an inauguration, dedication, ceremony. And it lasts 7 days. Throughout the ancient Near East, temple inaugurations. Other numbers too, but 7 is not unusual. 7 is not about the time it took to build the house. 7 days is the time it took to make that house into a temple, God's home. In that sense, the temple was created in 7 days. That doesn't mean that the structure was built in 7 days. Likewise here, if we're talking about a cosmic temple, the 7 days is about the house becoming the home. It's not trying to give you the time period that it took to build the house. Again, it's a functional origin story. The cosmos becoming God's place. Not a material origin story, the building of the house. Do you see the difference? Now again, I think we can see that not only in the biblical text itself, but also this is the concept throughout the ancient world, so it's not unusual that the Israelites would think in those terms. It also has great theological significance, so it becomes an important matter of God's revelation. He's much more interested in revealing the home story than the house story. The word day suggests it should be a 24-hour period. I've always believed that. That made me an uncomfortable young earther for many years. The discussion then often concerns the age of the earth. That's because we assume that it is a material account, that it's the house story. But that's an assumption. It's not automatic. It's not default. It would have to be demonstrated. And we just never thought there was another alternative. And I'm suggesting that there is indeed another alternative. Okay? If we think of the 7 days as the house story, well, then that would lead to something like a young earth. But if the 7 days is like a temple inauguration, then the objects are not necessarily being made in those 7 days. Remember, the word create does not automatically lead us to a material way of thinking. Now, it does for us, but it shouldn't. In the ancient world, it didn't. If the days are concerned with bringing order rather than making things, the 7 days has nothing to do with the age of the earth. In which case, the Bible makes no claims about the age of the earth. In which case, we are left to the science to tell us. Because the Bible has no claims to put on the table. Conclusion for this part, I'm not done yet. The text asserts that in the 7 day initial period, again, the 7 days refers to the whole, the beginning, God brought the cosmos into operation. There's the functions by assigning roles and functions. That's my extended paraphrase of verse 1. Okay, Genesis 2 and 3. This is the part that's not in the Lost World of Genesis 1. It's in the book I'm writing now called The Lost World of Adam and Eve. But okay, so here's the record here. Okay, first of all, Adam, Hebrew word, of course. Not just the person's name. It refers to humanity. There are 34 occurrences just in Genesis 1 through 5. Sometimes it occurs without the definite article. If it does not have the definite article, it can refer either to a personal name, Adam, or it can refer to a generic humanity. Okay, we find it both ways. 5 times as a personal name, the earliest possible in 425. But then also in the genealogies in chapter 5, where it's clear that it's working as a personal name. 4 times as humanity in generic sense, and I've given you the references there. But then it also occurs with the definite article, and this is nearly every occurrence in Genesis 2 and 3, okay, which are the ones we're interested in when we get talking about human origins. But here with the definite article, it can't refer to Adam as a personal name. Personal names do not have definite articles in Hebrew, just like they don't in English, unless you're the Don. But in any rate, usually doesn't have a definite article. 20 archetypal individual references in 2.7 through 3.24, 3 times in the preposition. That has its own particular problems in Hebrew. I'm not going to get into it. And so that's the information. So that's indicating that in Genesis 2:7 through 3:24, the human origins passages, we always have it referring to this archetypal role. Now, let me explain. I'm using archetype as different from prototype. Prototype is the first manufactured in a whole series that are going to be manufactured. Okay, that would be a prototype. An archetype, it is a representative of all the others in the class. Okay, so archetype has a representational element that makes it different from just a prototype. So we can talk about Abraham as an archetype of faith. Okay, because we all of the faith find Abraham as our father in faith. Okay, Jesus is an archetype. Okay, someone can be an archetype, and that doesn't address the issue of whether they existed as an individual or not. Okay, Abraham existed, but he has an archetypal aspect to him. And someone could emphasize the historical individual in a story, or they could emphasize the archetypal nature. Okay, it's just a different aspect to pick up. Likewise, Jesus was archetypal and also historical. Myself, I believe that Adam and Eve are historical, real people in the real past. Okay, but at the same time, I'm convinced that the Bible is more interested in them as archetypes than as historical people. I believe that both Old and New Testament treat them as historical people. But that's not the same thing as talking about what scientific claims might be made about whether they were the first people or the only people. That's a different question. Okay? Real people in a real past, but how do they fit in some of the other categories? And that's what I'd like to talk about some. Now, first of all, we have to talk about this important transition in 2:4. This is a literal introduction. Everybody understands that. It's these are the generations, or this is the account of the heavens and the earth in the day that the Lord your God created them. Okay, so it's a literary transition from the first account, the 7 days, to the second account with Adam and Eve. Now, what's the importance of that literary introduction? As you know, often we consider, traditionally, people have said that chapter 2 is giving you more detail about what happened on day 6. Right? And that's what you've usually heard. So that when God created people in his image in one day 6, now you come to chapter 2 and that's giving you more information about how he did that. Now despite that traditional interpretation, we've always noticed that gives us problems. Because there's an awful lot that goes on in chapter 2 to fit into that 6th day. We're talking about a 24-hour period. We're talking about man, the garden being planted, man being formed, the instructions about the fruit, we've got the threat being given, we've got the animals being made, we've got the naming all of them, and then the Eve moment. And boy, there's a lot of things going on in day 6. Busy times. Okay, so we've noticed that. We've also noticed the sequence is different. So we've got some difficulties to cope with here as we deal with this idea that it's reading back into chapter 1. Well, if we look at all of the uses of this literary introduction, and here's the list of them, there's 11 times that it's used. The G refers to genealogy. The N refers to narrative. So sometimes we find it transitioning from a genealogy to a genealogy, sometimes a narrative to a narrative, sometimes you can see it, okay? I've gone through and I've noted whether the transition leads us into a synoptic section or a sequel section. Synoptic would be something like Matthew and Mark, okay, where it's telling the same story again. Okay, that would be synoptic. If it's going to the next part of the story, that would be sequel, like Luke and Acts. Okay, Luke first tells the story of Jesus, then the story of the church. Luke and Acts are sequels. Okay, so you got the idea? Now, what we find is that we've only got one other narrative to narrative. Genesis 2:4 is a transition between narratives. The only other one that does that is Genesis 6:9. And we find that all of the examples of synoptics, the ones I have noted there, are relationships concerning brothers. Okay, well that's interesting because of course in Genesis 2:4 we don't have the section joining brothers. The synoptic view would be the view that we're dealing with day 6 in Genesis 2. If it's a sequel, that suggests some interesting possibilities to us. Oops. If the second account is a sequel rather than synoptic, that would mean the people in the first account are not necessarily Adam and Eve. And then the second account does not need to fit into day six. Now, this is where you could possibly get the idea that Adam and Eve are historical people, real people in a real past, but yet not necessarily the first people. If Genesis 1 is referring to a whole group of people, unspecified, just mass humanity, then Adam and Eve as a sequel may well come later. So you can see how we can distinguish the question of historical Adam and Eve from the question of first hominids or the scientific issues of human origins. The two accounts relate to one another. Cosmos as sacred space functions on behalf of people in the first account. People are put in sacred space to function on its behalf in the second account. Sacred space in the second account is the Garden of Eden. Okay, so we have sacred space involved with both, but we have different directions here. So I would propose that we've got the discussion of archetypal functions in Genesis chapter 2. Everything in Genesis 2 regarding human origins is first and foremost archetypal. The claims being made are archetypal rather than individual. The making accounts are most relevant to Adam and Eve as archetypes rather than as individuals. I'm going to explain exactly what that would look like, because I believe that dust and rib are archetypal issues. Okay? Dust deals with mortality. That is, the biblical text tells us this in 3:19, dust you are, to dust you shall return. So we find out that dust equals death. It's a good thing, because we really didn't work very well for dust to equal chemistry. Not a very clean statement to say that somehow we are chemically made out of the same thing as dust, although certainly some of the things on the periodic table work out, but it's still not that kind of statement. Furthermore, it was really intriguing that the biblical text used dust. You know, Job later on talks about we are but clay. That would make more sense. You can shape clay. You can't shape dust. So what in the world is the text using dust for? It's not using it for chemistry. It's not using it for shaping in that sense. What is dust here for? And the text tells you the dust indicates mortality. We are all made of dust. We are all mortal. Dust you are, dust you shall return does not refer just to Adam. It refers to all of us. That's why I call it archetypal. Okay, we'll get to the rib inside in just a minute. Okay, let's stick with the dust for a moment. This is the Egyptian monument relief. Here we have the god Khnum. He's a creator god. He's a craftsman god. So potters, you know, that kind of thing. He's working on the potter's wheel, which is here, and there's the character that he's molding on the potter's wheel. Now, we have a similar story actually taking place on the left side of the screen. The two goddesses are flanking the pharaoh. They're bringing him to make him pharaoh. And that's precisely what this picture is also conveying, because this is not conveying the idea that Khnum is fashioning the material body of the pharaoh, and that that means that he was created as human differently from everybody else. Okay? He's forming him to be Pharaoh, forming him for the task. Remember, God tells Jeremiah that I formed you in your mother's womb for this task of being a prophet. Okay, Pharaoh is being formed as an archetype of pharaohhood, of kingship, and they're forming him into a king. It doesn't suggest any different mode of birth or his own material origins. So this is the way they describe him being called by the gods to a role and a function. Now again, a modern artistic rendition there on the right. But let's take a look at Psalm 103:14. The psalmist says, "For he, that is God, knows how we are formed. He remembers that we are dust." Not the same vocabulary as Genesis 2:7, formed and dust. Same vocabulary. So it's clear that the psalmist is referring to Genesis 2:7. He goes on to talk in the next verse about how we are frail, which of course is what dust has to do with in Genesis 2 and 3. Okay? That much is evident, but notice what we often overlook. There's that very important first person plural pronoun, we. The psalmist has just made a statement that we are all formed from dust. All of us formed from dust. Yet, you were born of a woman. I'm assuming, is that presumptuous? You were born of a woman, but yet you are still formed from dust. What's up with that? Every human is formed from dust. Psalmist makes that clear. Genesis 3 makes it clear, because we're all dust and to dust we return. Being formed from dust does not describe material formation, because we know what your material formation was. And again, we can look at the example of the Pharaoh, where that's not what's being conveyed. Being formed from dust would not preclude being born of a woman. It doesn't bring to us. That means that when the Bible says Adam was formed from dust, it is not talking about his material origins. And it would not preclude him being born of a woman. It's not making that claim. See it? The Egypt king was formed on the potter's wheel to be king. But what's the role in Genesis 1? I'm sorry, Genesis 2, that Adam is being formed for. It's not his material origin, but his role, and that role is a priestly one, which we'll get to in just a moment. He too is formed for a role. Take a look at Zechariah 12:1. If you're inclined to say, well, the verb formed must refer to a material process. The Lord who stretches out the heavens, see we're in a creation context here, on lays the foundation of the earth, who forms, the human spirit. Not material. The human spirit. Formed by its nature does not have to be a material activity. Let's take a look at the rib issue. The term translated rib is never used for anatomy anywhere else in the Bible. It's not one. It usually refers to architecture, and usually it's one side of the pair. So you might talk about a double door. You've got a doorway and two sides, two doors. I think of a cabinet, and the two doors to a cabinet. They'll talk about the north side of the altar and the south side of the altar. Okay, so it's sides. That are represented. Now, that means when Adam says bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, he understands exactly what's happened here. He doesn't just say bone of my bone, which you would expect if it was just a rib that had been taken. He says bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Think about a side of beef. God took one of Adam's sides. That's not one of his ribs. That is one of his sides. He's only got two. Now, that's fairly radical surgery. But we have to ask the question, is the Bible thinking about surgery? Would Israelites think about surgery? Would they think about this as surgery? And one of the reasons we think about it as surgery is because it says he closed up the flesh. Well, what did he expect to do? Leave it hanging open? Secondly, we think of it as surgery because God put him into a deep sleep. Let's talk about that. The word for deep sleep is tardema, that's the Hebrew noun, the connected verb, radam. It can occur in a number of different ways. I'm going to skip the first two because I'm going to promote the third. That is unresponsive to the human realm and correspondingly responsive to communication from the divine realm. I particularly want to bring to your attention the Abraham passage, Genesis 15. There, that's the ratification of the covenant. Abraham cuts up the animals, and then in a vision, while he's in a deep sleep, the torch and the oven pieces. This is the ratification of the covenant. I mean, this is big news. This is kind of almost the biggest news until the coming of Christ. Okay, the ratification of this covenant, and Abraham is shown that in a vision, a deep spiritual truth about the nature of God's relationship to his people in a vision. I would propose that that's the same thing that's happening in Genesis 2. God has put Adam into deep sleep, not to anesthetize him for surgery. God has put him into a deep sleep because he has something important to show him. This woman is not just the feminine form of him. This woman is his other half. And he has built her out of his other half. So womankind is drawn from the side of mankind to be his helper, as the text tells us. Now, if we look at the following verse, you can see that the verse picks up the archetypal element. That's why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife and they become one flesh. Why? Because they are returning to their original state of oneness. When we're talking about one flesh here, it's not primarily talking about when they have sex. It's talking about the idea that they are restoring, reuniting what was originally a whole. And that's why the most important biological relationship, parents to children, is trumped by this husband-wife relationship. Because this is restoring something that was originally a whole. So, becoming one flesh is not talking about what marriage becomes, what it is. It's talking about what marriage inherently is restoring. Now, the priestly roles that I've talked about, we get that from Genesis 2:15, where it's serve and keep. We often think about those as if they are gardening, landscaping terms. Okay, that's, I think, a mistaken reading. Now, the verb serve here can refer to working the ground. It does refer to working the ground in Genesis 2 and 3. But because it's connected to keep here, I think we have to go a different direction. Not that yet. Throughout the Pentateuch, both words, serve and keep, are used to describe priestly functions. The priest's service in the temple is that first word, and that's how it's usually used. The guarding or keeping, preserving of sacred space is the second word. They are used together for the priests in Numbers 3. And so this idea that these refer to priestly roles, after all, that's the context. They're just in sacred space. And they've been placed in sacred space with a task. That task is not just taking care of the plants. This is far more than plants, and the garden stands as sacred space, and people have this role in it. He doesn't go seek a partner just for reproduction. Otherwise, he would have looked among the animals first. She's a helpmeet to help Adam in his sacred task. As priests, they are representatives of all humans. Now, this is the second level of representation. An archetype represents because all are inherent in that archetype. So Adam was formed, and we are all formed through Adam in that way. Priestly representation is one representing the other group, not because all are in them, but because they represent them. Two levels of representation, archetypal and priestly. The disorder of sin entered through them and permeated the cosmos such that all other humans are subject to that disorder. I just like that picture. Okay. Adam cutting the hat. Okay, so archetypes. But the details of the making, okay, here we're talking about side and dust. If those apply to the archetypes, that is, all womankind is from the side of all mankind. All humanity is made from dust. Then we have no information about the making of them as individuals. Again, I believe they are individuals, but this isn't talking about their origins as material individuals. It's talking about all of our origins. Archetypal identity does not negate the existence of the individual, but its emphasis is on archetypes. Again, in this way, I would say we do have a historical claim, Adam and Eve as real people, but that does not interfere with science and is not a scientific claim. That is, again, they were the first people or the only people. All the things that genetics has, nothing standing in the way, trying to understand genetics, population genetics as best we can. Nothing standing in the way of us trying to understand the concepts of common descent and all of those issues. Again, I'm not passing judgment on the science. I can't evaluate it. I'm not a scientist. But if we ask, does the Bible stand in the way of those? Does it give a competing claim? At this point, well, no, it's not giving a competing claim. The appropriate question then is not, is this really what happened, but is this what people really are? That's the archetypal question. I need to hasten along here. Okay. So the message of Genesis Archetypes, humankind was created with mortal bodies. Now again, that makes sense when you think about it. I know tradition doesn't think that way. But you can find church fathers all the way back who understood this and who mentioned it specifically. Okay, the fact is, dust says mortality, it shouts mortality, and the text tells you that's what it shouts. Furthermore, if people were created immortal, why would they need a tree of life? And the tree of life is what gives them resistance to their mortality. And when they're kicked out of the garden and they lose access to the tree of life, that's when they are now subject to death, not because they had become mortal and before they were immortal, but rather they lost the antidote to their mortality. And so death comes through sin. They are subject to death because of sin, because sin lost them access to the tree of life in the garden. So we don't need to think that humans were created immortal. The text gives us no such indication, and reasons we believe otherwise. Humankind was provisioned by God in the garden. He planted it for food for them. We're given the role of serving in sacred space. That's the priestly tasks, and it implies relationship. Again, guests in God's home. Humankind was divided into male and female, and so would seek out new family relationships. These are important theological issues, and these are the things that the text is talking about. It's not trying to discuss human evolution or population genetics. It has no new revelation to offer on issues of human origins, materially speaking. Material origins, if Genesis 2 has an archetypal focus, there is no biblical account of material human origins. Does not mean that common descent is true, only that it would not contradict the biblical record. There is special direct creative work of God, found at least at the functional level. The image of God, the endowed with the image of God, is an act of creation. It's giving a role and a function. Creation of a spiritual being. We believe that there's something of us that transcends biology, that exists after the body dies. Now, whatever word you call that, the fact is that's something that doesn't evolve and can't evolve. God has to give that. And the designation is priest. To give a function is a creative act. So, where does that leave us? I want to conclude on just a couple of brief points. Why is this all very important? Why should I bother traveling around the country for 8 months talking about all this? I think there are three very important reasons. First of all, lots of you are science people, and maybe you've experienced the kind of marginalization that happens when you're a science person of faith. In your workplace, you risk being marginalized because you are a person of faith, and that can bring scoffing and rejection. Theoretically, you should be able to find some solace and comforting encouragement in the community of God's people. But too often what you find there is also marginalization because you are a scientist. And you've accepted certain scientific conclusions, and that leaves you sometimes kind of out when it comes to the church. In that way, we have not been doing a very good job of ministry to people in science. We've left them dangling between. And it's hard enough to try to integrate your science person and your faith person, and this ministry is not taking place the way that it ought to. And shame on us as a church that we're doing that. And I think because we have assumed that there are certain scientific claims being made by the Bible, and therefore think that people of science have rejected the Bible when they've accepted certain scientific conclusions, there's no need for that. Secondly, there are plenty of people, who have some level of intrigue about Christianity. They're curious. They may be open. But somehow they've been given the message that if they are going to come to Christianity, they've got to throw out their brains. They've got to reject the science that they believe is utterly credible. And if I've got to become a young earther, if I've got to throw away evolution, I can't do that, and so I guess I can't come to Christ. And we are putting hindrances to the gospel when we encumber the gospel with those kinds of ideas. We can do evangelism better. We can do evangelism better by making it about Christ and not about this theory of science or that theory of science. And I think we need to do better with that. Finally, there is the attrition issue. We've got the serious hemorrhaging as young people are raised in the church, but unfortunately told that they have a decision to make because there's a conflict out there. And they've got to make a decision to either be people of faith, believing the Bible and Genesis, or they have, or if they become a science person, if they accept science, they rejected all of that. And they can't be a Christian anymore, and they can't really believe in the Bible seriously if they accept those scientific conclusions. It doesn't matter whether we accept those scientific conclusions or not. What matters is what our attitude is toward those people who do find the scientific conclusions compelling. Are we going to tell young people that they shouldn't go into the sciences because that's the devil's playground? And that only atheists can be scientists? We dare not give that picture. Though I'm afraid that when I went to the Creation Museum, that's exactly the kind of picture they're getting. Okay, do we tell people that if they accept evolution, biological evolution, if they accept the conclusions of population genetics, that they have to throw the bottles away? If we tell them that, it's likely they will. And decide they can't be people of faith. We don't need to push that choice. I've tried to demonstrate that a serious reading of the Bible leads to a situation where there are no scientific claims being made. And that leads you to decide the science on the basis of the science. And so, in a sense, we misrepresent God's Word when we portray it as having those scientific claims. You can see that I have not come to these conclusions by spurting the biblical material, by kind of being dismissive of it or saying, oh, never mind, it's just literary. Okay? I'd rather try to show that a serious reading of the text, both as biblical text and as ancient text, that is, in its ancient world, all drive us in this direction of seeing the text as accounts of material. No, not to count a material of functional and archetypal origins, not of material origins. Leaving the scientific questions open for science to resolve. The Bible has its own claims to make. They're important claims, but they're not those scientific claims. So, my feeling is that as a church, we need to do better. It doesn't really matter to me whether I change your view about interpreting the Genesis text. It does matter to me if I can change some attitudes about people who do accept a different set of scientific conclusions. Because in the church, we have to have better attitudes toward all of this. My feeling is that there really is not a conflict. And that the war is over. If we want it to be, we just have to get there. Thank you.
It's an instance of perfection. Fall and redemption and restoration. How would you describe things in that term where you say that man wasn't initially created perfection?
I would look for a distinction. Lots of times our classic Protestant theology especially has talked about original righteousness and then the fall of redemption. But there's always been a voice that said, no, it's original innocence, which means not that they were sinless or perfect, but that they were not yet accountable. And I'm leaning more in that direction. Again, you go all the way back to the Augustinian, Irenaeus debates and those kinds of discussions. So in that sense, I think we do have to have a real fall moment in history. Again, that's why I've got historical Adam and Eve, and I think that really fits best with all of that, with theology. But again, that doesn't answer the scientific questions. So, yes, the fall is central to how we think about theology, and certainly redemption is. But I think that beyond those, Both of those have to do with something that I would just term more broadly the word I use, relationship. That really our faith is all about relationship, a relationship lost and a relationship reforged through the work of Christ. Yes, sir.
So how should we interpret God's command to Adam and Eve not to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil?
As the text shows us, it's a wisdom tree that works with how knowledge of good and evil is used throughout the Old Testament. And Eve says it was desirable to make one wise. So this is a wisdom tree. It's not that wisdom is a bad thing, it's just that wisdom has a process. You learn wisdom under instruction and mentorship. And therefore, they weren't supposed to take it of their own accord. Wisdom, in the biblical terms, is the perception and pursuit of order. That's why creation is a big theme in wisdom literature, because that's God bringing order at every level, cosmic, social, family, okay, everywhere. And so wisdom is the pursuit of that. When they eat the tree of wisdom, they are following up on the serpent's suggestion, you will be like gods. That means that instead of seeing order as having its source and center in God, they try to grab that wisdom and make themselves the source and center of order. That's the big issue in the fall. I mean, it comes through obedience, but it's not all about disobedience. It comes because they seized the helm. This is a coup. They seized the helm and they wanted to make order revolve around them. God says, okay, you've opted out of my order then. And they leave the garden into a less ordered state. And you want to make yourself the source and center of order? Good luck with that. How's it going? That's the fall. Okay, so they weren't to take from it because, again, there's a process involved here. It's not because it was evil. But again, they usurped that role. Yes, sir?
At some point in the presentation, I believe you said that the term good meant more functional, functioning
yes.
properly. An interpretation like that seems different from our modern concept of good. And so what do you think that does for theodicy? Anything, an interpretation like that.
Again, we don't build theodicy on the word good. Well, some people do, but there's really no reason why we should. Theodicy, of course, is a complicated issue, and I'm not a philosopher, but I did just write a commentary on Job, so I had to think about it a bit. One of the things I keep hearing is that theodicy is a philosopher's pipe dream. That is, we've got no right to stand in judgment on God and His justice. Now, sometimes theodicy is framed in larger abstractions than that, I understand. But still, in the end, it's not our decision to make to try to defend or vindicate God as a just God. And the book of Job largely tells us we're incapable of creating a system that will accomplish that. So I don't think we should bring theodicy into that question. Certainly, it leads to important issues that we need to deal with. What do we think about a God who has this whole evolutionary process, if that's the case? The red and tooth and claw and things of that sort and suffering and all of those things are important issues. But I think there are other answers that can be given. There's a book coming out, what's the gentleman's name? I forget now, it's an IDP. And it has a whole section on animal suffering and addresses the issues very well. It should be out sometime this year.
What's the name of it?
The name of the book, I can't remember, I'm sorry. It has animal suffering in the title.
We need one more quick one, and then we have to go. Okay.
Well, I don't know how quick this will be. You said near the beginning, I think, that authority was in the hands of the author. And Peter Enns has come out recently with the book, The Evolution of Adam. And I'm probably going to over-reduce it entirely, but he essentially says we have no earthly reason to imagine that Paul would have thought anything except Adam was the first hominid, the father of the race. And that since Adam wouldn't have been the first hominid, therefore that aspect of what Paul is saying is not at all true or impossible to be true. Now, I probably shredded Dr. N's whole thought.
No,
but the question
too badly, no.
So, but but
give a 1 minute version, because I just found out we're supposed to be out of here by 9, and it's going to be a little challenge. So I need a 1 minute version.
Yeah, and I don't agree with Pete Enns at all. I think that he's right that Adam would have, I'm sorry, Paul would have considered Adam to be a historical person involved in a real act of sin. I don't think Paul addresses the issue of population genetics, or are they the only people. Some people think that he does, but again, when I look through the passages individually, I don't see him making that claim. I do not buy Peter Enns's argument that Adam just equals Israel, and this isn't really about human origins at all. He thinks it's a compelling case, he keeps calling it that. I don't see that it's compelling in the least.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you all for coming, and get the